Israeli jets keep pounding the Gaza Strip, killing more Palestinians, among them 8 children. The United States backs the deadly air raids. Meantime, Palestinians fire a barrage of rockets at Tel Aviv and the Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank in retaliation for the air raids on Gaza. And Iranians hold Tazua mourning ceremonies on the eve of the martyrdom anniversary at Imam Hussein, grandson of Prophet Muhammad. Good everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Israel keeps pounding the Gaza Strip with airstrikes. The raids that took place a short time ago have left at least 2 more people dead. They targeted the Jabalia camp in the city of Khan Yunus. Several people were also injured. This brings to 34 the number of Palestinians killed since Friday. The toll includes 8 kids. 2 senior Islamic Jihad leaders are also among the fatalities. Hamas's movement says assassinating Palestinian leaders won't stop resistance to the occupation. Meantime, in response to the attacks, the Islamic Jihad has fired hundreds of rockets at Tel Aviv and settlements across the occupied West Bank. The movement says it will not engage in any mediation effort until after it avenges the killings and the assassination of its leaders. I talked to our correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, and he says that Israeli troops are using unconventional weapons in their attacks against Gaza.
This is the 3rd day of the ongoing Israeli onslaught against the Gaza Strip. The number may increase due to the severe injuries of some of those who were injured due to Israel's use of excessive force against the civilians in Gaza. And to what some experts say, the use of unconventional weapons against the civilian population in the Gaza Strip. Israeli attacks continue to take place throughout the Strip, whether through airstrikes or tank shelling, while Palestinian resistance groups, mainly Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, continue to retaliate against the Israeli regime by firing volleys of rockets towards the Israeli regime to defend the Gaza Strip against the aggression that started on Friday with the assassination of top Islamic Jihad military commander Taysir al-Jabari when Israeli drones hit an apartment building where he was staying.
Israel's airstrikes against Gaza have triggered not just retaliatory rocket attacks, but also an array of international condemnations. Several countries, as well as regional resistance groups, have come out in defense of Palestinians, holding Tel Aviv responsible for the consequences of the escalation. In our news review program, we dug deeper into the issue with our correspondent and guest. Time now for the news review section. Do stay with us. Condemnations are pouring in following Israel's recent airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Iran's foreign minister says that the Zionist apartheid regime is to blame for the consequences of the escalation. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says that the Israeli regime is committing such crimes amid the silence and inaction of international bodies. He says it's the natural right of the Palestinians to confront the Israeli occupation and defend their homeland. The Hezbollah leader also condemned the Israeli aggression, saying that the regime is founded on the basis of crime and massacre. Saidus and Nasrallah hailed Palestinian resistance groups for confronting the attacks, noting they have proved Israel can be humiliated and defeated. The UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territory also slammed the latest round of the aggression against Palestine. The United States, though, has fully thrown its weight behind Israel, justifying the attacks as a means of self-defense. Other countries have offered across-the-board condemnations of the deadly violence. Syria has stretched support for Palestinian people, calling for Israeli atrocities to be prosecuted for the war crimes they're committing. Damascus says Palestinian people should band together and stand up to the aggression. Likewise, Turkey, Qatar, Jordan, and Algeria have condemned the Israeli air raids. Russia and the European Union have called for maximum restraint in Gaza. Okay, let's invite a couple of people and get more information on this. Ashraf Shannon, our correspondent, joining me live from Gaza City. Also with us is Zakir Ahmad Mayat. He's an attorney, activist, and political analyst in Johannesburg. Ashraf brings us the latest. The casualties mounting, more and more Palestinian people are being killed to Israeli raids, among them, unfortunately, children too. Tell us what the situation is like in Gaza.
Yes, Bahrouz, the Israeli regime continues to kill and maim, Palestinians in the enclave since Friday. Scores of Palestinians have been killed and close to 300 were injured. The latest figure by the Ministry of Health hasn't been updated yet. It still stands at 29, but I believe the number is much higher. But there are at least 8 children among those who were killed during Israeli bombardment as this onslaught continues against the civilians in the Gaza Strip. A new aggression against Gaza began Friday afternoon with the killing of a senior commander of the Islamic Jihad's military wing of Quds Brigades, Taysir al-Jabri, who is in charge of the Islamic Jihad's military wing in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Well, yesterday, the Israeli regime fighter jets assassinated Khaled Mansour, who is in charge of the southern part of the Gaza Strip in the Al-Quds Brigades. Israel says that the aim of this operation, Breaking Dawn, is to weaken or annihilate the resistance movement of Islamic Jihad and its military wing. But from what I'm seeing and what observers are witnessing, the volleys and the number of and the barrage of rockets that continue to be fired towards the Israeli regime, and the fact that Tel Aviv has ordered the town of Sderot, close to the Gaza Strip, to be fully evacuated, is that the might of Islamic Jihad is increasing as they defend and retaliate to the Israeli aggression. Right now I'm standing inside the Shifa Medical Complex in Gaza City, where the civil defense just ended a press conference talking about the fact that they lack the equipment to rescue equipment to help save the lives of those who are trapped under bombed buildings.
Now let me turn to Johannesburg. Zakir, you are an attorney, you're a lawyer, so let us know if such aggression by the Tel Aviv regime is or is not in violation of international law.
Okay, sorry, I couldn't hear that question. Could you please repeat?
I just ask you about, as an attorney, for you to comment about the latest Israeli aggression against the Palestinian people. Now they are hitting Gaza, children and women are losing their lives. Is this not in violation of international law?
Most definitely. I think the comments by the special rapporteur to the occupied territories of Palestine sufficiently encapsulates the legal framework around the current phase of aggression. It was started with a preemptive strike on the Palestinian Islamic Jihad commanders, and Israel has consistently bombarded civilian areas. Now, this is not something exceptional, as Israel tries to pay to the international world and the media that they are trying to limit casualties, that it is Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the other factions that are using civilians as human shields. To the contrary, the Israeli military has been indicted for using civilians as human shields by their own Supreme Court. In fact, if you look at all the human rights reports, it always states that there's no evidence of human shielding. However, Israel is the one that uses a process called the Johnny process, where they utilize a civilian to clear buildings, etc. Further to that, Israel said this in 2006, This was under Major General Ghadir Eisenkot, where they called it the Dahiya principle, to cause maximum damage to civilian infrastructure so as to create pressure on the resistance movement to desist from resisting and defending themselves. So this is a principle of Israel. It has always been based on terror. It continues to act in a terrorist manner. And it is a terrorist state. It's a lunatic state. It's off the cliff.
Okay. Thank you so much for your comments and insight. Ashraf Shannon in Gaza City, Zakir Ahmed Mayat in Johannesburg. Okay, welcome back. Let's move on. In another act of aggression, more than 900 Israeli settlers backed by military forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Just hours ago, they swarmed the holy place while chanting slogans marking what they claim to be the anniversary of destruction of Temple Mount. Israeli troops adopted tight security measures in and around the mosque, preventing the guards from confronting the settlers. Now, the raid came despite a warning by Hamas against any encroachment upon the premises of the mosque. The resistance movement has reacted by condemning the Tel Aviv's authorities, authorizing radical Zionists to attack the mosque. The movement is urging Palestinians to join hands to counter the raid and defend their land. Millions of Iranians are marking Tasua as part of mourning ceremonies commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad.
خورشید روشن شیه تاریکو چون شن
دیگه روانش با بیلا خوش به سر آمد.
Tazua is the ninth day of lunar month of Muharram, a day before Ashura that marks the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam. Tazua is the day when Imam Hussein and his companions were besieged by the enemy during the Battle of Karbala. Every year, black cloud mourners attend mosques or parade in the streets for rituals that involve rhythmic chanting and beating of their chests and reciting elegies in honor of Imam Hussein. The Imam and 72 of his comrades were martyred after fighting thousands of soldiers of the second Umayyad Caliph in Karbala Desert in today's Iraq in 680 AD. Now, our correspondent Yusuf Jalali also attended one of those mourning services here in the Iranian capital city of Tehran.
Where I'm stationed is the University of Tehran, which is hosting one of the largest mourning processions for Imam Hussein. And the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, is also in attendance here. Of course, people during the 10-day mourning rituals listen to elegies in honor of Imam Hussein and eulogies also in admiration of Imam Hussein. People are shedding tears. It's as if Imam Hussein was killed yesterday. And the reason is, these people say Imam Hussein holds a special position among the Muslim people in Iran and outside Iran, as they regard Imam Hussein as a symbol of resistance and sacrifice for the sake of Islam. These people say without the sacrifices of Imam Hussein, Islam as we know it would have not existed. That is why they owe the existence of Islam to the sacrifices made by Imam Hussein 14 centuries ago. They said that Imam Hussein stood against the Yazid ibn Muawiyah, who was the second Umayyad ruler, the second Umayyad caliph, who did not practice Islam as taught by the Prophet. And that is why Imam Hussein stood against Yazid. He did not pay allegiance to him, and he stood against Yazid, and that sparked the Battle of Karbala, where Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were brutally killed by the Yazid forces at the time.
Now, while millions of Muslims are mourning the martyrdom of the third Shia Imam, the legacy of the Imam in Islamic history continues to win the hearts and minds in the Western world, too. Our London correspondent, Robert Carter, has talked to some Shia Muslim converts about the same topic.
Prayers, storytelling, and tearful rhythmic chanting are all expected when Shia Muslims begin their annual Muharram commemorations across the globe. Shia Muslims mourn the first 10 days of the Islamic month of Muharram in remembrance of the martyrdom of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson Imam Hussein, who was unjustly slain by an oppressive tyrant some 1,400 years ago. It isn't only in the East that you witness the mass commemoration of Imam Hussein's legacy, but also a growing community in the West, particularly of Shia Muslim converts, are benefiting tremendously from the story of Imam Hussein. We spoke to one convert who explained to us why he felt Shia Islam was the ideal faith for him.
That's what I did like about the following of the Ahlul Bayt, because I could see in the condition of black people in the past, we suffered quite a lot in the past. And when you look at the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, it's there too, that they see people suffering and they didn't like it in their time. And similarly, when we reflect on Hussein and our lives today, we've got to think Hussein didn't like that we mistreated and not respected as a human being. So it's important that we emulate what he stood for.
Despite the growth, some community leaders feel more work is needed to be done to support new converts. Shia Muslims currently make up about 15% of the estimated 3 million Muslims in Britain, with well over 100 mosques across the nation. Ensuring Imam Hussein's memory is being shared like never before. Robert Carter, London.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "Pilgrimage of the tomb of the Messenger of God and the martyrs, and pilgrimage of Imam Hussein's tomb, equals to an accepted Hajj that has been performed in the company of the Messenger of God."
Welcome back, everyone. In the first part, we saw how in 1951, inhabitants of a French village were suddenly tormented by terrifying hallucinations. At least 7 people died, dozens were taken to a local asylum, and hundreds were affected. Immediately, wild theories started emerging to explain this mysterious case of mass insanity. There were claims of poisoned flour, contaminated water, and even witchcraft. The truth was stranger than any of these theories. The Central Intelligence Agency had spiked the local food with LSD as part of a mind control experiment at the height of the Cold War. And with time, U.S. government's interest in LSD shifted from a defensive to an offensive orientation. While the initial experiments with LSD were fairly simple, if shockingly unethical, over time, these LSD experiments grew increasingly elaborate. Stay with us as victims reveal the naked truth in the next part of this program.
Entire populations bore the consequence of large-scale tests. Here are some examples. Again, uncontested cases that are recognized by the American government. In 1953, radioactive iodine was injected into newborns and pregnant women at Iowa University and also in Nebraska. In 1955, the CIA sprayed whooping cough bacteria off the coast of Tampa. Two died, and dozens fell ill. Also in 1955, the CIA enlisted prostitutes in San Francisco, opened two brothels and tested drugs on the clients, then filmed through a one-way mirror. In 1956, the Army released millions of mosquitoes carrying yellow fever and dengue on the towns of Savannah and Avon. There were several deaths and hundreds of people infected. In 1960, in Cincinnati, the Army financed a radiation program on 90 destitute or ill inhabitants of the city's university hospital. Some died after several weeks. In 1966, the Army tested a virus in the New York Metro, then in Chicago. The bacteria was concealed in electric bulbs. The aim was to study the spread of chemical agents on a large scale. For these experiments, the Army or the CIA funded laboratories in the most prestigious universities: Yale, Stanford, Harvard, or Columbia. They all took part. Glorified by the idea of working for the nation's defense, the researchers went crazy.
Dr. Kligman in Philadelphia increases a dosage 468 times, which actually frightened Dow Chemical. They couldn't believe that a respected doctor would do that. In Washington, D.C., you had Walter Freeman, who was a very, very well-known lobotomist who traveled around the country doing lobotomies in his car. And he would use an ice pick. He could do 15 to 20 in a day. It was just incredible what some doctors did, and very few, if any, people in the hospital or the medical community blew the whistle on it. It really was an egregious act, and it showed that the medical community was more interested in protecting its ass than in protecting the test subject and the patients, because a lot of doctors went off the deep end and started doing things that are just inconceivable now.
To express his indignation, Alan Hornblum wrote half a dozen books. A former prison guard at Holmesburg in Pennsylvania, from his first day at work over 40 years ago, he had a horrible shock.
I was stunned to see scores of inmates with their shirts off, strapped and wrapped in bandages and gauze tape. And I couldn't imagine that I was going into an atmosphere that was that violent, because all of the men looked like they had just walked a cell block knife fight.
They explain that it's not because of any violence, but experiments that are carried out there. Allen was the first to denounce this scandal and would lose his job as a result.
It was probably the largest human experimentation factory in America, possibly the world. From 51 until 1974, more people were probably incorporated in more experiments than any other place in the world.
Drugs, viruses, cancerous cells, plutonium, sarin gas, the most toxic products were tested in Holmesburg, but also in dozens of prisons throughout the country. To condemn these experiments, Alan Hornblum found former inmates like Youssef. In 1961, this man was imprisoned for selling marijuana. He was poor, with limited education. He was offered a chance to take part in tests for a dollar a day. Since then, Youssef has had his digestive tract operated on. He has liver and skin problems and can no longer work. His first test was for a bath foam from the company Johnson & Johnson.
They took tape and they stuck it on your back and pulled it off, stuck it on and pulled it off until the first layer of skin came off your back. And they put six sections on my back like that. And then they took a bottle with the Johnson & Johnson bubble bath and put it on a patch and put the patch over the raw area. Then they took a can. I recognized that can as being from the Army. And I was like, what Johnson & Johnson got to do with this? So he took the can and he sprayed it on my back. And when it hit my back, it was cold. But it was so toxic and like fumes, I could taste it in my mouth. And as I'm walking down, I'm getting dizzier and dizzier, dizzier and dizzier. By the time I stepped into my cell, I passed out. Boom, and my back was inflamed. And by the time I woke up that morning, I had great big blisters on my back full of pus. This rash just gets worse and worse. And it looks like when the moon come out at night, it flames up. And I'll be moaning and crying. My cell partners couldn't sleep. We goes over there, a little shot cup, and it looked like water. We drinks it. Everything became magnified. The sound, like the loudspeaker on the system, ooh, ooh, ooh. The walls looked like they turned into water. You know what I mean? And like I spent the whole time like looking around like this here instead of doing the test. So I goes back to the block in that condition, and man, I mean, I was tripping. And it was like a slow-acting drug that was in that cup. It lasts for weeks. The inmates start naming me out of limits. I had no conversation for nobody. I was scared of the inmates, and the inmates act like they was afraid of me.
What you had were hundreds and hundreds of uneducated minorities, overwhelmingly black and Puerto Rican, and then you had white doctors with white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name, and it was a recipe for abuse, if not disaster. And those prison walls are an ideal spot to do controversial experiments, because just as those walls keep the inmates in, they also keep the public out, so no one finds out about it.
Prisoners were used, but also patients. In certain hospitals, patients were steered towards the services financed by the CIA. These services carried out limitless experiments on psychological manipulation. In 1965, Karen Wetmore was only 13 when she was admitted to a hospital in Vermont. She stayed there several times in her childhood. She suffered from severe depression after falling victim to a pedophile neighbor. Admitted against her will, she was not allowed any contact with her family, being told that it was for her own good.
The CIA was specifically looking for children between the ages of 13 and 18 to further dissociate. They wanted dissociative children. There's a sense of absolute and total helplessness. You're there, you're bound up, you're locked in this room. No matter how you scream, no matter what you say, no one is gonna come. It does something to you, something you don't get over.
The doctors went to work on Karen. They wanted to erase her memory and create a robot at their command. It took 30 years of legal battles for Karen to obtain her medical records and discover the violence of the treatments she was subjected to.
It says seclusion, full cam. A cam is a straitjacket. And ties, which means they tied my arms and they tied my feet. This goes on uninterrupted, day after day, week after week, February, March, April, right up until June 21st, 1971, you sleep on the floor. On the floor. No blanket, no nothing. And my arms were secured like this, behind my back. I do remember that. It's extremely painful because it pulls on your neck, pulls on your shoulder. You can't get away from it. It's maddening is what it is. Maddening. And I was naked. And I think that was part of the effort that experiment to break me down. Everything they did was to break me down.
Months in a confined room with no bearings, while her captors administered all kinds of drugs and sometimes electric shocks at inhuman levels.
Number of shocks and the seconds that they held the shocks. They had 30, 30, 35, 35, 35, and they held it for sustained for 40 seconds. A normal shock would be a second. Certainly not 30 and 35 of them. One, not that many, which probably is what obliterated my memory right there. And I think that's the way they did it. They also said, in this treatment right here, no seizure, shock restarted. So they gave me a second one because they couldn't produce a seizure. So they must have done it over again. They must have repeated it. It's unforgivable. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one they did this to. I'm sure. I survived to be able to talk about it.
How many suffered similar experiments? In Montreal, Canada, the CIA used a world-renowned psychiatrist to set up a factory of guinea pigs in the Allen Memorial Psychiatric Department in McGill University. This psychiatrist was Ewan Cameron, one of the all-powerful presidents of the World Psychiatric Association. In 1945, Ewan Cameron made the acquaintance of Rudolf Hess, one of the Nazis accused in the Nuremberg trial. In 1957, the CIA recruited him for their MK-Ultra program. The Americans wanted to perfect their interrogation techniques and program a human to kill. Ewan Cameron became the mad dog of psychiatry. He put his patients in vegetative states for several weeks while bombarding them with pre-recorded orders. Some would become incontinent, amnesiac, forgetting even who their parents were and how to speak. The Vermont hospital where Karen Wetmore was confined was working on the same program in the hands of the CIA doctors. She was like a rag doll.
They used drugs like LSD. They used electric shock. They used chemical shock agent metrazole, which I was given in 1971. And I found that out in my medical records, which is a very brutal drug, very brutal drug. CIA said it was excruciating. Physically and emotionally, excruciating drug. I have a quote from the CIA that said that the Soviets used it in the gulags, and that a POW would say or do anything to avoid a second dose. Nice drug.
There's all kinds of people who believe and people who don't believe, and that's a debate about do you believe or don't believe. I'm always interested in what are in the documents saying. So the documents clearly describe implanting electrodes in people's brains, activating the electrode from a remote transmitter, and changing the person's behavior from angry, pounding the wall, sitting there just staring.
Behind Karen's ear is a scar, and she doesn't know what it's from.
Once my therapist really understood that I had really been experimented on by the CIA, she said to me, you know, just for the heck of it, let me look. Because we'd read about, there's been information about these implants. And I'm like, okay. And it was there, actually there. I showed you. I went to a plastic surgeon who told me it was a surgical scar. But there's nothing in my medical history, nothing in a medical record that shows any kind of problem ever. Behind my right ear, or any incision or any surgery or anything else. But there it is.
What stopped the journey down this destructive path? In 1973, while Watergate is rattling all the institutions, Richard Helms, director of the CIA, feels the winds of change. He works as a lone wolf, and hasn't informed the president of these experiments. He knows he's crossed the line. To protect himself, he orders the destruction of all documents relating to the MKUltra program and its abandonment. 2 years later, in 1975, the President Gerald Ford orders an inquiry into the CIA. The Rockefeller Commission is sworn in. The task isn't simple, because at the heart of the CIA, even Richard Helms' close lieutenants know nothing about the brainwashing programs.
There's a lot of goofy things go on in a big agency like that with all that secrecy. Things can go on that you don't know about, that the people who are working for the director most closely don't know about, or that the director doesn't know about. I mean, they're keeping it quiet down there. Don't tell anybody. If it works, then we'll tell them. But, you know, in the meantime, don't get into any difficulties. I remember when they wanted to take a kitty cat and stick a microphone up its rear end and put an antenna on its ear and have him walk in where we, if there's a spy in the park with another one, walk over and walk around and listen in on it. You know, they tried it one time in an experiment, and a taxi came by and ran over the cat, you know. So.
In reality, nothing is funny. In its haste to get rid of evidence, the CIA forgets 20,000 documents. A drop of water compared to the amount that was destroyed, but they reveal that it financed 149 programs, implicating 80 institutions, including the most respected. Called on to justify themselves, the heads of the CIA, like Dr. Lashbrook, lie and downplay the facts.
There was, of course, claims or thoughts that maybe great things could be done with hypnosis. One small project in which we had a hypnotist do some experiments, primarily to see what the limitations of hypnosis might be. Can you make a person do something under hypnosis that he would not ordinarily do?
Even if the head of the CIA, Richard Helms, tried to minimize the scale of the experiments, the victims' testimonies contradict him.
The next thing I remember,
the inquiry commissions follow, each reaching more and more witnesses, like this woman, Chris DeNicola. Her father put her in the hands of a reputed CIA doctor, Dr. Green, when she was 12 years old.
His objective was to gain control of my mind and train me to be a spy assassin. Dr. Green had electrodes on my body, including my head. He used what looked like an overhead projector and repeatedly said he was burning different images into my brain while a red light flashed aimed at my forehead. In between each sequence, he used electric shock on my body and told me to go deeper and deeper, while repeating each image would go deeper into my brain and I would do whatever he told me to do. Dr. Green moved on to wanting me to kill dolls that look like real children.
Inquiry reports that resulted from these terrifying testimonies revealed one thing for certain. The experiments ended in disaster. In its insane quest for a robot human or a truth serum, the CIA failed. On August 3rd, 1995, with the revelations mounting up, then-President Bill Clinton makes a public apology. Since then, a great number of secret archives have been released to the public domain. Researchers would take an interest in this troubled period, notably Hank Alberelli, who worked on the suspicious death of Frank Olson, the biochemist who worked at the heart of the CIA. Since 1951, the year of the Pont Saint-Esprit incident, Frank Olson called into question the ethics of the experiments being carried out and became depressed as a result. In November 1953, the CIA put LSD into his glass without him knowing. 9 days later, he threw himself off the 13th floor of a New York hotel. Murder or suicide, we'll never know. At the time of the investigation, Hank Alberelli found a surprising document coming from the White House. It surprisingly linked the name of Frank Olson to Pont Saint-Esprit. Why in the middle of the Korean War would the White House be interested in this small French village? Even better, Hank also came across a study carried out by the CIA on LSD.
The document itself was a comprehensive overview or history, if you will, of LSD specifically, yes. Not on ergot. It had nothing to do with ergot. There was a section or a chapter, if you will, headed incident at Pont Saint-Esprit. And the first two paragraphs of that describe essentially what we've all read, you know, many times over in terms of what happened at Pont Saint-Esprit. But the remainder of that section, the rest of that page, which was about half the page, and the two pages that followed, were completely blacked out.
Above all was this damning document from the CIA. It dates from 1953 and has no doubt been declassified by mistake. A director at Sandoz Laboratories confirmed to a secret agent that the Pont Saint-Esprit incident was caused by LSD. Sandoz Laboratories was where Albert Hofmann worked, the man who discovered LSD. It even claimed the drug was responsible for the Pont Saint-Esprit tragedy, before recanting. This same document states that in 1952, the source at the CIA had already explained that the cursed bread was caused by LSD. Did French authorities try to silence the affair? Several years after the drama, a head of the Victims Association was shocked at how disinterested the investigators were. Do the French have something to hide? We've interrogated former members of the Secret Services, investigated national and regional archives, as well as those from the police and the Justice Department. The files are hard to find, and many important pieces, such as reports from main hearings, have disappeared. If America revealed unwillingly some of its secrets about its participation in the poisoning, the uncertainties over the involvement of the French authorities may yet go on for some years longer. It takes 75 years for some sensitive documents to be made public. Hidden in its small streets and stone buildings, Le Pont Saint-Esprit drama has yet to reveal all its secrets.
Judging from the CIA's dark and notorious past of misconduct, perhaps it'll be no surprise if horrific clandestine high-tech experiments are being carried out somewhere in the world by the CIA at this very moment. Secrets that we must wait 75 years to be declassified, if ever disclosed to the public at all. And that's everyone for this week on Aperture. It's goodbye.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear friends. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to Lantern. We have an interesting story. Today's story entitled Habib ibn Mazahir. He was about the same age as Imam Hussein. They were childhood friends. When Hazrat Ali moved the capital to Kufa, Habib also moved to Kufa. He stayed on in Kufa and became a prominent citizen. He was a devout Shia. The first letter which Imam Hussein received inviting him to Kufa was signed by Habib ibn Mazahir. After Muslim ibn Aqil was killed by Ibn Ziyad, Kufa was sealed off. No one could get in or out of the city without the governor's permission. Habib ibn Mazahir was heartbroken because he could not join Imam al-Hussein. He did not even know where Imam al-Hussein was. There were all sorts of rumors, but no one knew anything for certain. Imam Hussein had reached Karbala. On 4th of Muharram, Imam Hussein wrote a letter to Habib ibn Mazahir, his childhood friend, telling him how Yazid's vultures were gathering to kill him. The letter was carried by a messenger who entered Kufa in the dark by climbing over the city walls. The messenger reached Habib's house. As Habib, his wife and his young son were sitting down for breakfast. Habib read the letter, kissed it, and tears began to flow down his cheeks. His wife asked him what was wrong. Habib said, "Who would ever have thought that people would be so thirsty for the blood of the grandson of the Holy Prophet, whose name they're uttering every adhan and in every salah?" At Asr, in the evening, when most people were in the mosque, Habib slipped out of Kufa. He mounted his horse and galloped towards Karbala. Habib ibn Mazahir reached Karbala late in the evening. Imam Hussein greeted Habib with great affection. On the fateful day of Ashura, between Zuhr and Asr, Habib ibn Mazahir rode into the battlefield. He fought bravely. Finally, he was overpowered. He fell to ground. Imam Hussein rushed to him. Habib looked at Imam and said, "Oh, the grandson of the Holy Prophet, please forgive this humble servant for not being able to give more than his unworthy life for you and Islam." The Imam took Habib in his arms and cried, "Oh, my friend, oh, my friend." Habib was killed, resting his head on Imam's shoulder. Dear brothers and sisters, accept our sorrow and condolences on the month of Muharram. I invite you to listen to the continuation of this program, Lantern. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa bi nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with certain aspects of the life and times of Habib ibn Mazahir al-Asadi, who was one of the Ashura martyrs in Karbala. Habib was such a devout person, and he was very much a very pious person. On the authority of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Habib ibn Mazahir al-Asadi recited the whole Quran overnightly, every night and overnightly. Regarding his religious piety, it must be indicated that Habib ibn Mazahir was a very pious person, and he wasn't devoted to this worldly life. Rather, he also reminded himself and others of the life, of the eternal life in the world hereafter. And it must be indicated and asserted that Habib ibn Mazahir, he was such a personality that when Muslim Aqil migrated at the command and order of Imam al-Hussein al-Salam from Mecca to Al-Kufa, Habib ibn Mazahir got associated with Muslim Aqil because, Muslim Aqil represented Imam al-Hussein al-Salam. And when the city of Al-Kufa and its suburbs were all surrounded by the agents of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, so that nobody would be able to escape Al-Kufa in order to join Imam al-Hussein al-Salam, Habib ibn Mazahir preferred to take rest in daytime, and in the evening and in midnight, he made his way in order to escape the guarding soldiers around the city of Al-Kufa and its suburbs. And then he joined Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the seventh day of Muharram. He joined Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the seventh day of Muharram, and for doing so, he received the warm appreciation of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And then, since Sabi ibn Muzahir was a man who belonged to Banu Asad, I mean the Asad tribe, Asad Arab tribe, he suggested Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he suggested Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to go there and to bring more forces for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Well, he went there and he talked with his own his own people over there. They wanted to come to help Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. However, the agents of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad reported that Habib ibn Muzahir was collecting forces, was recruiting more forces for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And because of this, and in order not to get entangled over there, without having doing anything, to be entangled and to be arrested by the security forces of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, Umar ibn Habib ibn Muzahir preferred to escape the situation and to join Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam anew. And he did this.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
On the day of Ashura, first of all, his horse was hamstrung, and then after that, when Habib ibn Muzahir was dismounted, he continued fighting the Umayyad forces. And one of the Umayyad soldiers over there, by the name of Budayl ibn Maryam, beheaded Habib ibn Muzahir al-Asadi, and he was martyred in that way. And then when he was martyred over there, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam went to him and appreciated his braveness, his bravery, his contribution, and his crucial role on the day of Ashura. Regarding attitude of Habib ibn Muzahir to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, it's very noteworthy that on the eve of Ashura, when Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam collected all his male companions in a very large tent and delivered his speech for his staunch companions over there, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated and asserted that he never expected anybody to remain with him, because on the ensuing day, that is on the day of Ashura, everybody on his side, that is in his camp, would certainly be martyred. And then one by one, the companions of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam started expressing their attitudes to him, to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Among them, Habib ibn Muzahir al-Asadi was one of those people who stood up, and because, he was an old companion of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, he stood up and delivered a short talk in support of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and indicated that if he would be martyred for 1,000 times, yet he was still very much zealous to remain on the side of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And this is a good indication of his devotion to the camp of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.